Space Alliance International Podcast.
I don't make this stuff up.
You know, if you put Jesus Christ first, that he'll look after all your bills.
It's not fake. It's faith.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Atheist Alliance International Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Sylvester. Joining me today are two writers, Matthew Britt and Jaron Wingo, who have written a book called Christ Before Jesus, and they're here to present their findings. Now, just a warning to people, this is going to be a little more intellectual than some of our other discussions. So if you're into intellectual atheism and the history and textual criticism, then this is going to be a podcast for you. But, you know, this is not everybody's cup of tea. So just a heads up that this is going to be a little bit more intellectual than some of our other conversations as we get into some of their claims. Now, some of the claims they make are going to be a little controversial. I was thinking about this as I read through their book over the last few days. So think about the fact that the scientist who first speculated that continental drift was responsible for the geology we see on the planet today. Now, he was pretty much laughed at the scientific academy until it basically became commonly accepted. So what Matthew and Jaron have done, you know, they're kind of out there on the outskirts of what might be academically sort of acceptable, but who's to say they're not pioneering and what they're doing is going to become the accepted scholarship of the future. So I'm going to reserve judgment. Yes, some of it is controversial. I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but it's definitely intriguing. So let's get into it. So Matthew, Jaron, thanks for being here today. Thank you for reaching out and sending me a copy of your book. So maybe just briefly, just give us a quick background introduction to each of you. So Matthew, why don't you go first?
Cool. So my background's basically started in philosophy in undergrad, got a master's in public administration, then went into work at a nonprofit where I started kind of managing their databases. And, it was a health careers type of thing. So a lot of, student information, a lot of doctor information, and then moved up to director of that program for about 6 years. And I've always had an interest in this field, not just from like the religious perspective, but from the historical perspective. For me, this is a very historical project, regardless of one's religious beliefs or views on this. And wrote this book, and it's been a great experience.
Okay. So just this field. So we haven't explained what this field is yet. So, but we'll get into that. So,
yes.
Okay. Jaron, so how about you introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Jaron. I have a degree in economics and statistics. My background, a little bit about me, is that, I was more or less a Christian missionary, so to speak. I've been on about 7 or 8 different mission trips around America, different states, different countries, and more or less, was heavily involved in the church. The son of a deacon in Southern Baptist Church, and definitely raised in that particular community. I've been an atheist since age 21, so about 10 years ago, but started looking into the history of Christianity just, out of curiosity, out of concern for, historical kind of desire to learn. And that's what kind of led me towards, taking a look into the life of Jesus and the historicity of Jesus.
Okay. Great, thanks. Okay, so let's dive into. So the book is called Christ Before Jesus. So maybe just I got a sense of what the title means, but maybe just for the audience, just give a quick summary of why you chose that title.
Yeah, so Christ Before Jesus, we talk about that concept throughout the book a little bit, and even I tried to actually use the phrase a little bit just to kind of tie it in. But it's the idea that the stories of Jesus come around after the concept of the Christ figure that the Christians specifically were worshiping or believing in. So there's a lot of people who technically would have been considered Christs, whether they be someone as far back as King David, you know, being anointed, or Simon Bar Kokhba, there of the Bar Kokhba Revolt, Third Jewish Roman War, there in the 130s, he would be considered a Christ to some particular Jews of the time. Even Theodas or Judas, mentioned, not Judas Iscariot, but the Theodas and Judas that are mentioned in Acts. And then even, according to some scholars, John the Baptist, his followers, the Mandeans, would have worshipped him or seen him as a Christ. So, I mean, there's definitely a lot of speculation that you could do over the idea of which particular Christ they believed in, or even if they were human. There's talk about Serapis Christus being a possible candidate for the Christians up in Asia Minor, which is the first Christians that we hear about from Pliny. But overall, you know, having a Christ figure be the deity that you follow or believe in doesn't necessarily mean Jesus.
Okay, so just to put some definitions around this for the viewers who might not necessarily be that familiar with the terminology. So in ancient Judaism, so a Messiah, the Jewish word for Messiah, is basically the anointed one. So as we saw recently with the coronation of King Charles, the anointing of oils of a sovereign. So in ancient Judaism, the kings were messiahs, but after the Babylonian exile and the elimination of the Davidic monarchy, there were calls for the restoration of the Messiah, and that goes through multiple incarnations, which we've talked about on a previous podcast with John Collins from Yale. And we'll put the link in for people who maybe want to check that that podcast out. So the Christ is being then the Greek word for Messiah. Right. So the Messiah then is thought to be either going to be a warrior or a prince or even an angelic person or being who will come and restore the kingdom of Israel. So we have in Judaism, there are lots of people who are considered messiahs because they in some way have challenged the status quo. So there are numerous candidates for that. So one of the interesting things in the book, and forgive, I didn't have time to get through the entire book, but you posit that the origins of Christianity are not so. Let me just back up a little bit. So that we have two definitions we need to define. So we have the historicists and we have the mythicists. So the historicists are people like Bart Ehrman who think that there was a historical Jesus, someone whom around there was this charismatic mission that these stories have coalesced around. And then you have mythicists such as Richard Carrier and others who believe that Jesus was never a real person. It was just all of these stories that come together. So in your book, do you actually, if, because you guys say you started off as historicists and then you became Jesus mythicist. So in that reading then, if Jesus was not a real person, but was an amalgamation of all of these characters, where does the church come from then? Where do these people who emerge as Christians, where do they, how does this come about? I don't know if you talked about this in the book or not, or it was just, it's sort of an afterthought for me is like, okay, if there was no real person, then how did this movement actually get started?
Yeah. Chapter 9 of the book, we do end up getting that. So it's the very end of the book. We kind of give a timeline of everything. And it's a really good question because, you know, where did this whole thing come from if there wasn't somebody starting it? And kind of like Jaron was saying, there were probably various movements, you know, with various figures, both Jewish and probably even non-Jewish in many cases, that had a Christ deity or Christ figure. And that's what we see in Pliny's letter, that they just worship a Christ. And he interrogates them, tortures them, goes into what he calls their temples. And, you know, he never mentions finding any texts. He doesn't mention a Jesus figure or, you know, any figure other than their Christ deity. So what we think happened is that these various beliefs about a mythical, and by mythical, we mean more spiritual in this case, deity, a Christ figure, were just floating around mostly in Asia Minor, but probably across the empire. And then when the first gospel came out, which we think was proto-Mark, which is like a version of Mark that's earlier than our canonical version. That was the first iteration of a Christianity that had a Jesus figure, and he probably descended from heaven. So we have a gospel that comes out in the 140s, and it might be one of the first ones to be published by Marcion, who later gets branded a heretic, but his gospel also had Jesus descending from heaven directly. And from there, it gets more and more historical. You know, you start to get birth narratives, and of course they're miraculous, but they're still, they further and further tie him into a historical period. But the earlier versions seem to have been a more spiritual figure that descended and may have been on earth, may not have been. It's unclear exactly how the text was supposed to be interpreted. And they still have people today, like debating on how to interpret various parts of the gospels and Paul's letters and such. But yeah.
So Proto Mark, what was your estimate for when Proto Mark emerged prior to the gospel Mark?
So we put that around the 120s. So what we see, and we're not the only people that have been working on reconstructing Proto-Mark. There's Mark Bilby, who got something very similar to the size, which is about 1/3 of our canonical Mark. We know that, you know, Pliny doesn't find any mention of any kind of text, whether it's letters or a gospel. We also don't see anything in Tacitus or Suetonius about mention of them having texts. And we know that probably likely that the concept of Mark and priority is still legitimate, even if Marcion in the 140s came out with some other kind of synoptic gospel that would have been based off Mark. So it's got to come out around, you know, before really 135, because we'll have to get into that in a bit. But more or less, the dating for Mark right now in the mainstream scholarship is around 70. And they base that off of the chapter 13 in Mark, which talks about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. But there are lines in there that hint that it may have been about the Bar Kokhba revolt ending in 135, but that was not in this early version of Mark, meaning it probably, that event probably hadn't happened yet. So we place it before 135, but it seems to use Josephus, meaning it would have to be after, you know, the 90s or even the start of the second century there.
So let me just trying to do justice to your book and your research. So I've read it, but our viewers haven't. So maybe just a quick summary then of the analysis that you guys put into this and the statistical rigor you put into it, you know, with the style analysis that the software did. So maybe you can give us a quick overview of how that worked and how you guys came to your conclusion so that people can understand where you're coming from by placing Proto-Mark in the second century AD or CE.
Right. So what we use is a program called Stylo. It is a peer-reviewed software out of a group of scholars working from multiple universities called the Computational Stylistics Group. It's run on the R programming language, and it does computerized stylometry. And so stylometry is the analysis of style in writing and speech and other things. What this program does specifically is, it does a variety of things, but how we use it specifically is we look at a most frequent word list. And in this case, we can run from anywhere from 100 up. We tended to run between 100 and 500 most frequent words per text. And we do this all in the original Greek of the New Testament and various other early Christian texts from the second century and third century. And what we find is the software is able to identify authors. And we test this on known authors like Clement of Alexandria, on Origen. We know these texts, and the software will lump them together correctly. And so when it lumps things together, it makes kind of a dendrogram, which looks like a family tree. When they're lumped together correctly, we know that, you know, the method is working properly. If they were scattered and like it puts Origen with Clement, with, you know, Eusebius and so on, there would be a problem. We don't see that though, once we, you know, clarified and cleared up our methodology. And from there, we run this on the New Testament, and we're able to look at roughly a chapter level size text. And when we do that, we see that all the versions of that so-called Olivet Discourse or Little Apocalypse that's found in Mark 13, Luke 21, and Matthew 24 has significant style variations than the rest of those gospels, meaning it was probably sourced from something else. It wasn't originally in Mark for the first place. But then when the other Gospels right. came out, they copied it from probably when Mark put it in, but possibly just from another source that they got.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So people who may not be aware, so people like Bart Ehrman and his book Forged have talked about this, like how there might be like the letters of Paul. There's like 14 letters of Paul that are in the New Testament, but only six to seven are considered legitimate. But even within the legitimate letters of Paul, there are certain insertions.
Right.
I can't remember off the top of my head the exact biblical reference, but we have evidence of other writers within certain books. So even within a book, like Isaiah or Micah in the Old Testament, you have examples of there's more than one writer writing under this name. So what you're seeing then in your stylometric analysis is that even within certain chapters, a different voice is emerging. That's yes. fair to say?
Okay. Yes. And you all see right. this at the end of Mark 16, and that's pretty agreed upon. There's something called the long ending of Mark, where if you open the NIV, for example, you'll stop at verse 8. And then it'll say, after this, some manuscripts don't have the following text. So 8 through, I think, 20 does not appear in most of our oldest manuscripts. And when we run that chapter, we see that the chapter itself is also a different voice from the bulk of Mark, meaning that was added later. So we are able to confirm that. And that's something that a lot of mainstream scholars agree upon, is that that long ending of Mark was not written by the same author.
Right. And we see this throughout the Bible in different books, mm-hmm. where certain passages, entire chapters of certain books of the Bible, clearly and stylistically, and the word choice, it's clear, or even in terms of the topics they're discussing, it's clear that they are not contextual to the era in which this book is supposedly set. So, for instance, in the Old Testament in Isaiah, there's actually three versions of Isaiah, Isaiah 1, 2, and 3, where the first Isaiah is actually contextual to the time of the Assyrian conquest, but the later chapters of Isaiah are referring to examples of historical events that do not happen for several hundred years. So, for example, the Pauline epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy, or Titus and Timothy, I can't remember mm-hmm. it, they're clearly discussing a hierarchy of an organized church, which does not exist within the first century. So we see that kind of example showing up in the letters, like where the Pauline epistles, where they're discussing a situation which clearly does not exist in Paul's day. Okay, so you guys have run an analysis and you've come to the conclusion that, so the scholarly consensus is Matthew is 65, 70, around the destruction of the temple, Matthew, Luke come after the destruction of the temple, and then John is probably 95 to 100 CE. You guys are saying, and this is where we start getting kind of controversial, but there's definitely something there, that you're hypothesizing that no, these dates probably are not accurate, that the New Testament canon as we understand it does not emerge until the second century AD.
Right. And honestly, the logic they use right. in a way isn't too far off from what we say. We say that Mark was probably first, and then, 10 to 15 years later, there was a Luke or Matthew next, and then John is still the latest. We see things in John that just textually comment on or require the knowledge of the previous Gospels. So a lot of the scholarship still works. It's just the reference point that's used to date the Gospels is not in the original text and seems to be talking about events that happened in 135 using a backdrop of, the 70 destruction of the temple, as a lot of other prophetic texts do. You're talking about the Old Testament, how like they still write as if it's about a certain thing, even though this later author is, hundreds of years later sometimes. In this case, we think they're using the metaphor of the destruction of temple to talk about the destruction of all of Judea. And they have references in there like those who are in Judea should flee in the mountains. But the destruction of the temple, should have been pretty localized to Jerusalem, for example. Yeah. And then there's other things like that, like a reference to the abomination of desolation, which refers to a statue being built, which is referring back to Daniel, where that happens. And that happens again, not at 70, but around 135 or so when Hadrian does that.
In the temple. Or mm-hmm. on temple.
Right on the Temple Mount.
Because the temple has already been destroyed 70 years before.
Right.
And then Hadrian puts up a statue on Temple mm-hmm. Mount. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So you're referencing the Bar Kokhba. So the people who don't necessarily know the history, so the Bar Kokhba revolt was a Jewish revolt in the early 130s, so like roughly 132, 33 to 35, 36, in which the Jewish population is essentially dispersed. This is where you see the main Jewish diaspora and the eviction of the Jews out of Palestine into the Middle East and into Europe. This is also when Hadrian renames the area Palestine, correct? Syria, yeah. Palestine. So, okay. Right. All right. So your conjecture then is the books of the New Testament themselves, as we know them, the four Gospels, and even Paul, you mentioned, this was interesting, that Paul, the signs in Paul actually point to a BC Paul, not to a post-Jesus Paul. So that is, I think, quite controversial. So
yeah,
I would think that's probably going to be one of the hardest ones to back up. But it was intriguing that you guys pointed to the fact he's mentioning certain cities that, was it Corinth? That Corinth had already been.
He mentioned someone from Corinth, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Erastus, yeah.
It's talking about like around 10 CE, the province gets divided and renamed. So why would Paul be writing to a city that political name no longer exists in the first century?
Right. Yeah. So that reference is to the province of Illyricum. And Illyricum, okay. Yeah, you said it, around about 9-10 CE, it got split into two. And so if Paul is writing in the 50s, then I mean, it would be 40 years away from that name being used for the province. So it seems a bit strange. Now, that being said, while we do explain that there are a lot of things within the letters of Paul that could possibly point to a BCE Paul, our overall take on Paul is that either there's some core of the letters that actually do come from that era, or someone very close to that era, which is BCE, or they're just really, really bad anachronisms trying to place Paul into a particular timeline, and just missing the mark by quite a bit. But even still, in the second century, you have quite a few different church fathers or church leaders who had a different view of like how old Jesus was or when Jesus actually existed, how long Christianity had been around. And so it almost sort of kind of excuses some of the attempts to put Paul into BCE, because again, there was a little bit of confusion even within Christianity as to how old the religion was, you know, when Jesus walked the earth, if he walked the earth. They're still fleshing it out. So when Paul was, when these letters, when we say that they were written in specific, it would have been pretty early into the development of Christianity.
Okay. And so the main core of your book, Christ Before Jesus, is the Gospel of Marcion and its similarities, or what's the right word? Its parallels to the book of Luke, correct? Okay. So maybe just give us a quick background on who Marcion was and what your research points to.
Yeah. So Marcion is from depending on who you are, you might have a different pronunciation of the word. We tend to call it Sinope. I think there's Sinop and a whole bunch of different takes on how to pronounce the hometown of Marcion. But that being said, Marcion's from northern Asia Minor, which is present day or modern day Turkey, up near the Black Sea. And he, at a certain point, reaches out to, or he comes down to Rome, the community of Christians, or the church in Rome, as it's put, in about the 130s or so. He shows up in Rome with a sizable donation to the church. And in his possession, he's obviously got some kind of copy of the Gospel of Mark, you know, the proto-Mark, an early version of it. And eventually he does not see eye to eye with a lot of their beliefs, the Christian beliefs. And so he is more or less kicked out of the church. His donation is returned to him. And in 144, he publishes a canon that he calls the New Testament. He's the first to really use that phrase for the canon. And that would have been in 144. And that would have included Evangelion, which is the name of the gospel that he published, and 10 letters, I believe it's 10 letters of Paul. And yeah, I mean, it was definitely a very good starting point for the Marcionites, who were people who, you know, followed him, students of him. And it was definitely deemed heretical from the rest of Christianity. But we are able to date that to 144. And so using Marcion as a bit of a, like a stake in the ground, so to speak, we're able to stop the circular reasoning that kind of says, oh, well, this book is dated using this book, which is dated using this book, which is dated using... It's the way to kind of stop the carousel from going round and round. We hold on to something firm, which is the dates of Marcion and his publication in 144. And you are correct. Yeah. In our book, we use the stylometric analysis to see that the Gospel of Luke definitely used the bulk of Evangelion for its content, from roughly Luke 4 all the way to about Luke 20, 21, somewhere in there.
Okay. And so he's using proto-Mark as his basis, and he writes Evangelion, which then becomes the basis for the book of Luke, which gets further. So the gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, then emerge post Evangelion and the Marcion's gospels and letters of Paul, is what you're hypothesizing. That
yes, we posit that Matthew was more or less a response to Evangelion. Seeing as Evangelion still has Jesus coming down out of heaven and into Capernaum and preaching, he still doesn't have Nazareth as the hometown or anything like that. But then Matthew is the first gospel to really try to make Jesus historical by giving him a genealogy, by giving him a bit of a birth story there, not as much as Luke, but still a birth story. But more or less, it's a response to Evangelion.
And then Luke itself emerges from Evangelion, and a birth narrative similar to Matthew gets added to it. Other stuff gets added to it to become the canonical Luke.
Yes, yes. And the Gospel of Luke, still to this day, we can see evidence in the text that shows that the compiler or editor, whatever you really want to call him, of the Gospel of Luke had taken from Marcion's Gospel and pretty much removed the first part about Jesus coming down out of heaven as a fully grown man, and replaced it with a birth story, not only of Jesus, but also of John the Baptist, but replaced it with a birth story of Jesus, and then just kind of merged the two documents at a certain point. And that's problematic because there's a line in Luke 4, I believe it's Luke 4, 23, I believe it is, and that verse in specific states that Jesus is talking to people, and Jesus says, oh, I assume that next you're going to ask me to do signs like I did back in Capernaum. But the problem is, in the Gospel of Luke, he hasn't been to Capernaum yet. That line is only found in the Gospel of Luke and in Evangelion. And in Evangelion, like I said, Jesus descends down into Capernaum, starts doing miracles, preaching, that kind of thing. So it makes sense in Evangelion, but the line doesn't make sense in the Gospel of Luke because they ripped out the part where he comes down into Capernaum. A few verses later, he goes into Capernaum. It's pretty obvious, even in the English, that there is something going on, that they've more or less jammed a couple ideas together, Marcion and the birth story.
Right. So then in your analysis, what then are your dates for when the canonical gospels emerge? That is a challenge to the scholarly ones of between 60 to say 95. So you guys put the dates where?
We would put the earliest version of Mark, like we said, around 120, 125, somewhere in there. Obviously, Evangelion is published in 144. The Gospel of Matthew, we tend to put it somewhere about anywhere from 145 to 150. It's a response to Marcion. The Gospel of Luke, we have somewhere anywhere between 155, about 155, 160, somewhere in there. John is a little strange because John assumes that you have read certain passages from the Gospel of Luke. But the issue is, you could have technically got some of that from Evangeline, because Evangeline is the basis for the Gospel of Luke. So John could be somewhere in 150s, or it could have been after the Gospel of Luke, which puts it as late as about 165 or so. But we do see names attached to the Gospels from Irenaeus or Irenaeus. They're about 180. So, and there starts to be attestations to them, quotes from these Gospels at a certain point. And so, you know, you've got an end point. You've got a time that you can't put it past.
Right, and that's where I was going to jump in and say that Justin Martyr is a really good second anchor. He's writing in the 150s to 160s before he's martyred, and there are other quotes from Gospels that are scattered here and there, just like one-off lines. Justin Martyr extensively paraphrases Matthew, Mark, and Luke throughout his writings, including some of the content from canonical Luke, like just I think two or three verses. And you could say, you know, those were taken from Justin Martyr, but it sounds like he's getting them from some text that he's reading. And these texts don't have names yet, which is why he doesn't say Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But he doesn't really seem to know any John content. So that's why we think the John Gospel, even if it had been written, it wasn't in Rome at the time. So that's going to be 150s to 160s. But his student, Justin Martyr's student, Tatian, includes John in his document called the Dia Tesseron, which is a harmony gospel that included all four of the current canonical gospels. So that's a second kind of data point that we have that, yeah, there are like one-off references here and there that just, you know, they're really small, but Justin Martyr is the first to extensively claim written documents said these particular lines or something like that, that we find in the gospels.
And I don't want to steal your thunder. I'll let you guys explain it. So you have two leading contenders for who you believe wrote the remainder of the New Testament beyond the Marcion's initial writing of, sorry, I guess Proto-Luke would be if we call the Evangeline Proto-Luke. So who are your two contenders then for who then wrote Matthew, Luke, John, you know, Paul's letters and stuff?
Go ahead, Matthew.
So it's more of a compiler, but because we do see different authors there, but we think that either Polycarp or Irenaeus, who claimed to have known Polycarp or be his student, and they appear, you know, more or less 150s to when Irenaeus writes his Against Heresies in around 177 to 183, they're the first to mention or quote Acts. Irenaeus in Against Heresies has an extensive section against Marcion, claiming that he stole the Gospel of Luke, more or less. He also really builds up the characters of Mark and Luke and is extensively quotes Acts. There are dozens of quotes from Acts in his works. And before that, almost nobody mentions it other than Polycarp. And we only find mention of Mark and Luke. in Acts and in some of the letters that most scholars consider to be inauthentic Pauline letters even today, because like you said, only six or seven are accepted as authentic. Two of the three references to Mark and Luke are found in the inauthentic letters. And we mentioned that Mark is possibly derivative of something like Marcion's name. Marcion's name would have been pronounced Marcion, and he had a student named Lucan or Lucian. It probably wasn't specifically those people who wrote it, but there are traditions that are around when he collects these four gospels and gives them names that he probably is kind of winking or nodding at it. And this lines up to another reason we put this date is because if you read Luke 1, there's a reference to a Theophilus who Luke is being addressed to. Same with Acts. A lot of people have wondered, is this Theophilus like a general God lover? Because that's what it means is, you know, Theo and Phyllis. But it seems like if you use our dating, you actually have a person it's written to, and it starts to just make things line up. And in there, you know, he even says, I'm taking this from other sources. I am, reordering it, which, you know, Jaron was referencing. We get a reordering there in Luke 4. So it looks like one of those two people are top contenders. And we're not the only to posit that they compiled the New Testament. David Trobisch is another scholar who puts Polycarp as the top candidate for it. We're not completely on our own up here on some of this right here.
So my reading of your book was you were suggesting that Irenaeus and Polycarp were the ones who wrote Luke, Acts, maybe some of the other letters, or did I misread that?
No,
or you're actually suggesting, okay.
Yeah, and then they would have compiled the rest. They didn't write all of the rest, so to speak. They might probably very likely edit it, because we do see traces of what looks like Polycarp in the pastoral letters, which you had mentioned, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, which are considered the latest letters of Paul. We see, like you said, pieces of that, like that kind of theology just kind of stuck in other letters. A good example is in Colossians. Colossians isn't considered an authentic Pauline letter usually, but it's considered earlier than the pastorals. But then at the very end of Colossians, you see this section that looks like it's almost cut and pasted from one of the pastoral letters, talking about like the submission of women and things like that, which otherwise Paul doesn't talk about it very much right. In his authentic letters.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So is it just Luke and Acts that Irenaeus and or Polycarp wrote, or do you think he wrote some of the other canonical books of the New Testament?
Well, just those? At the end of 2 Timothy, we have Carpus mentioned near the very end, and that would have been part of the Latin name there for Polycarp, Polycarpus, and also his scribe, who is mentioned in some of the writings of Polycarp, Crescens. So Crescens is mentioned in second Timothy as well, right around the same spot there at the end. And it was a common trope at the time to actually include the author's name at the end of a text in some kind of creative way. And in this particular regard, or in this particular case, who was it that was being asked to get a
yeah. So,
cloak?
So in that letter, the author, which, you know, is ostensibly Paul, is asking for Carpus to return his cloak and Paul's letters and writings. The cloak is something that was used in other, what's called epistolary fiction, which is basically just fictional letters, to have the author kind of shoehorned in there as like a cameo. That's not the first time that a letter in Greek had a author come in and deliver a cloak, because cloak being, I guess, the concept might have been like, you know, you see someone from behind, it's their cloak, that's them. But there's a great book from Patricia Rosenmeyer called Ancient Epistolary Fictions, which goes into extensively how like the way people learned to write back then was to get in the mindset or like the persona of a historical or mythical character and write from their perspective. That was literally one of the things they used for training. So, you know, we've got letters from like the wife of Hercules and people like that, which, you know, they didn't exist. It was just a practice. But we also have other, you know, their letters from Plato, which most scholars don't agree, all of them are authentic. It was just a common practice to do this type of thing. And we see that in Paul. And then in this case, we see a direct trope being lifted from that general type of fiction, referencing an abbreviated version of what looks like Polycarp's name, and then mentioning his scribe Crescens, who only appears in all of New Testament studies for like that century as the name of a heretic in Justin and a, or not a heretic, like a cynic. And then Polycarp's scribe in Polycarp to the Ephesians, or not the Ephesians, the Philippians. He shows up and he's his assistant or his scribe. So, and then in 1 Timothy, we also get a reference to Marcion's text called Antitheses and Gnosticism, which Gnosticism is supposed to be a second century movement. But there's direct reference to so-called Gnosticism in the Greek.
So. Yeah. In the Greek, I mean, anybody could look at an interlinear Bible and see that, I believe it's 1 Timothy 6:20, I think it is, that actually states in the Greek to stay away from antitheses. But we translate it into English. We say stay away from inane babblings or nonsense.
Right.
But the Greek word is specifically antitheses, which is a book that Marcion came out with that explained his theology.
Right. Okay. So you've got basically Luke and Acts written by, say, probably Irenaeus, and then he's compiling all of the other writings into the New Testament canon. Okay. All right. So what are the, and so I mentioned at the beginning, you guys started off as historicists, that there was a historical Jesus, and now you're mythicists. So one of the interesting points, I did not know this was new for me. You mentioned that Nazareth, he says there's no garbage dumps, no buildings dating to the early first century, no contemporary lists, documents, or maps containing the name of the city. So that was new for me, that I had not heard that before, that Nazareth does not show up in the contemporary period of when Jesus was supposed to have existed as a town in that period. So this is, again, a first, second century, or like late, maybe post-temple destruction, where Nazareth becomes a town.
Right,
that shows
right.
up in the archaeological record.
Right. I mean, the first mention whatsoever of any place even remotely called Nazareth or anything like that comes from the Christians. Evangelion, in published again in 144, it mentions Nazara, but it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't have, it mentions a town called Nazara, but it doesn't have Jesus coming from Nazara. Jesus is very clearly, his hometown is Capernaum in Evangelion. It isn't connected too terribly well with Jesus until the Gospel of Matthew, when they're trying to put together more of a historical thing. But that, again, in the second century is the first time we see any kind of reference to a town called Nazareth or anything of the sort. It actually doesn't show up in any non-Christian sources until, I think, the 300s or the 400s. Like, it doesn't really show up very, very quickly. And again, Josephus was a Jewish general in the first Jewish-Roman War, born in 37. He's from Galilee, and he lists tons of towns in his book, or in his books, his different books, the Wars of the Jews, Antiquities of the Jews, his autobiography, Vita, or Life of Flavius Josephus, but he never mentions Nazareth. He talks about a town called Sepphoris, which is just a small town, and it shows up on lists and maps from the time, but Nazareth doesn't show up.
Yeah,
and I know go ahead.
I just think it was interesting that I had not heard that before, that the archaeological record, like not just the list, but like there's not even like archaeological evidence of a settlement on the site, the current site in the first century.
Correct. They do. And this is something that we run into quite a bit. So there has been reports. There have been reports about people finding coins or people finding pieces of pottery. But unfortunately, when these findings are made, they say, oh, this could date to, and then they kind of give a quite a bit of a range. But over time, historians take a look look at these things, and the dates end up getting more exact, I guess, or not exact per se, but a little more localized to a particular time. And it's never going the direction of the historicist there. It's going later. And that was something that we see even with, say, the earliest manuscripts that we have of the Book of John or anything from the New Testament, which, you know, some of your viewers may be thinking, wait a minute, these guys are saying the Gospel of John shows up in like 160. Don't we have a manuscript that dates to 125? And the answer is no, we don't. When P52, which is the fragment of the Gospel of John, which is the earliest fragment that we have, or the earliest piece of a manuscript that we have for any of the New Testament, when P52 was first found and kind of sort of dated, they used paleography to date it, which is the study of handwriting, and they put it between 125 to 175. However, the John Rylands Library, which is where P52 is housed, has actually come out and said, while yes, it is still the earliest manuscript or earliest fragment that we have, it's actually dated to closer to 200. So what we hear a lot whenever we're, say, you know, doing a Q&A session on TikTok Live, or we're doing some particular presentation at a university, we hear people talk to us about, oh, well, they dated this to 125. And it's like, no, the problem is they come out and they say these dates, but then things get moved as we learn more about it. And so when pottery or coins or something is found in the site of Nazareth, or where, you know, they believe Nazareth, you know, old town Nazareth was, or ancient Nazareth was, all of the sudden people start to jump and run towards that and claim that that is the end all says all. But then over time we learn that it's actually something that's quite a bit later.
That's one of the things I was thinking about earlier, that, you know, this type of scholarship is dynamic, it's evolving, whereas
right.
theology, religious beliefs tend to be locked in stone, that, you know, this happened in this particular time, but
very
scholarship
true.
Is constantly evolving. And that's where I was alluding at the beginning, that, you know, something like plate tectonics and continental drift was kind of laughed off by scientists, and now it's the accepted sort of answer. So
right.
there's no reason why, while you guys are kind of out there on the fringe, there's not to say that you're wrong and that it won't become accepted in time as more and more evidence continues to come in from, you know, better carbon dating of these scraps of papyrus and analysis and things like that. So, and again, like the stylometric analysis, like big data and being able to run, you know, these Greek texts through a stylistic analysis program and being able to compare it against the writings of other people. So while it's certainly controversial, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. I certainly can see that you've got some science behind it. You know, we've talked offline, you know, you've reached out to some other scholars like Bart Ehrman to verify what you guys have found and are still waiting to hear. So it's definitely, I mean, So you guys, you started off as historicists and then you say you're mythicists. So that's because things like Nazareth doesn't exist, the Christ theory, you know, there's multiple Christs, you know, not just one. So it was there a key moment for each of you where you kind of went, I'm a mythicist now, or was it just
that's a really good question.
you can be thinking about that. I'll go ahead and give it a shot. For me, and Jaren is probably going to use this one, so I'm going to go ahead and steal it, is we started like just researching, and then eventually we were like, we need something more objective, which is the stylometric analysis, because it's, you know, a computer that's running this mathematical equation on text. And it's not us like saying, well, this word seems to mean this in this text and so on. So we run that and we start seeing these weird things that they don't line up with what a first century, you know, text would be, or they're lining up with second century documents. Like we see some overlap with Ignatius and some of Paul's letters, for example. And I joked to Jared, like, what if this is all in the second century? And then it turns out, like, some people, like, you know, just the other night I found something by, his name's Jacques Savoy. He's a Swiss scholar who more or less, he has our findings on Paul, that most of the Paul stuff is not actually by the same author, has it peer reviewed in a computer science journal. But yeah, I was thinking, you know, if this is all second century, then what it looks like is our first reference to Christians and Christianity is just a vague mystery cult kind of reference. It looks just like you see things like the cult of Mithras and stuff like that. And there's no indication that, you know, a lot of these mystery cults were based in historical figures. It looks like the trend was a deity. And then eventually the Christ label got stuck to a name. And then from there, it just built up. I was more skeptical of the mythicist position up until towards, you know, the stylometric analysis came out. And then when I said, you know, if these texts are second century, then the references to a historical Jesus come after references to a Christ deity. And what about you, Jared?
For me, I think the like the light bulb moment was Nazareth. I mean, in all honesty, because the biggest thing for me was, not only is there this huge argument from silence, right? But the issue is that in the Gospels, Nazareth is played up in the canonical Gospels. Nazareth is played up as this really terrible place, or not really terrible, but, you know, people look down upon it, you know, but it's also somehow part of a prophecy. Like it just doesn't really line up. Again, there's no evidence whatsoever that it's a place in the first century. We don't see any reference to it. It just wasn't a place. It just wasn't. We don't have anything from it. But at the same time, Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, it states that Jesus moved to Nazareth with his family after coming out of Egypt, you know, during the whole Herod massacre of the innocents thing. They hide in Egypt and they go to Nazareth afterwards. And it says he moves to Nazareth so he can be called a Nazarene according to the prophets. So in other words, Nazareth is apparently part of a prophecy. But not only do we not have anybody living there or any proof that anybody lives there or anything like that in the first century, which is strange, because if it'd be something from prophecy, you'd think that everybody would move there so their kid could be their kid could be the Messiah. But on top of that, if it's from a prophecy, why are so many people saying what good can come from Nazareth? And it's like, what are you talking about? Yeah, it's in a prophecy. You know, apparently it's a very important place. A lot of good, the savior of mankind can come from Nazareth. So why are you talking crap about it?
But there's nothing on the other hand that refers to this. There's no actual passage we can point to.
There is nothing. There is not a single reference in the Old Testament to a town called Nazareth. The closest at all that anything can get is, I believe it's Samson, who is said to be, it says that he is going to be a Nazarite from the womb. But that's the Nazarite vow. That doesn't mean that he's born in Nazareth. It has nothing to do with it. We know what the Nazarites are according to the Old Testament, but that's not someone from Nazareth. So it almost seems like somebody who is vaguely familiar with the Old Testament, but not completely, is trying to maybe tie in that prophecy, but that's the best we've got. But what my point is that a lot of people have said, oh, Nazareth was like a really, really small town. That's why we don't see much archaeology from it. That's why it's not even on the maps. That's not why it's no one lists it or anything until the second century. It's a really small hamlet of a couple families. But in the Gospels, it's big enough to have a synagogue. It has a lot of men to mob Jesus, and a bunch of people apparently know about it because they say, what good can come from Nazareth? You got to know what Nazareth is in order to say that. So it doesn't line up. Nazareth just doesn't fit with the story. It makes it a very big problem.
Okay. So just to tie it all together now, we've been talking for about an hour now. So I want to tie it together. I want to bring it back to what I mentioned earlier. And Matthew, you used a key phrase there that I think is key. So at the beginning, I asked, where does then Christianity come from? And Matthew, you just mentioned, like, you know, there were all these mystery cults. So it sounds then that what you guys are hypothesizing is there was multitude of mystery cults. But then suddenly in the second century, one of these mystery cults then emerges with a proto-Christianity, with proto-Mark, with the letters of Marcion and other cults. So it's essentially coming out of a mystery cult of some sort of spiritual deity, messianic deity.
Right, yes. And it was likely infused with Jewish elements, because we know that there were a lot of Jewish diaspora, even in the first century, in the area that Marcion's from, Pontus and Bithynia, which is also where we find that first reference from Pliny. He was the governor of that region in modern day northern Turkey. They had these texts that a lot of them probably didn't use, because most of them weren't Jewish, but maybe a few, you know, moved into the mystery cult from Judaism. And we see, you know, yes, like, for example, baptism was a ritual practice in Judaism, but it was also an initiation rite in a lot of mystery cults. We see a lot of overlap with mystery cult practices, especially in Paul. A communal meal, for example, things like that. And it also ties into the general theme of Mark, of how, you know, in Mark, Jesus is telling people, I speak in parables so they don't understand. People don't know who Jesus is. There's kind of this air of mystery about it. And that's the theme that, you know, a lot of modern scholars pick up on just in the canonical text too. So probably what seems to have happened is that this one of the branches of this mystery cult had a number of Jewish elements in it, had this Christ figure, and then eventually a story, possibly even like an initiation play, became something like Proto-Mark. And then that got picked up by Marcion. And when it got to Rome, by the time his gospel came out, it had a lot more historical detail. And from there, we get Matthew, who is really interested in tying it into history. And from there, by that point, you know, you've got a generation of people who have believed this was a historical tale at that point. And then, you know, it's history. So
the idea of a mystery cult that becomes Christianity, coming about and around the turn of the second century, maybe a little afterwards, is definitely pointed to by the fact that I think the first Christian father, or the first church father that we have who was a child convert that we know of, was Irenaeus. And he's writing in 180. He would have been born somewhere about 120, 130, somewhere in there. But everyone else is... they're adult converts, you know. Anytime that we hear about the conversion of these people, they're adults whenever they're converted, and that just doesn't seem to be something like, if you've had a religion since the crucifixion of Jesus in 30, why you would still be elevating people who were adult converts to positions of authority and power in your religion seems odd in the second century. 100 years later, you're still putting people who just switched to Christianity and, you know, as bishops. That just doesn't make much sense. It would make more sense that this was a fairly recent development, a fairly recent religion. But when Pliny, when he talks about the Christians that he finds up in his region that he was governor of, he describes them as pretty nice people, that they share resources, they share money, they share food, they get together, they you know, sing songs, and if they lend you money, they won't pester you to try to get it back. I mean, he's saying some nice things about them at the same time that he's, you know, torturing them, unfortunately. But the depiction that he kind of paints of Christianity is very similar to a group called the Therapeutae, which was a sect of Judaism that is talked about in Philo. Philo talks about them there near the beginning of the first century. and they were in Alexandria by Lake Merodis. They were like a small, like a Jewish cult, so to speak. They lived on a, you know, like basically a commune, and got together once a week to meet and share a meal. And they read from the scriptures, the Old Testament. And that was actually something that probably evolved into Christianity. So much so, it was so obvious that even the Christian writers, and some of the Christian writers actually, specifically Epiphanius, he actually claimed them as the first Christian monks, despite the fact that they would have been around prior to Christianity. But he claimed that they were actually Christians because they were so incredibly similar to what Christians were. That's probably a pretty good source of where a lot of their beliefs and practices came from, was the Therapeutai.
Cool. Great. Okay. Well, we've been chatting for an hour now, so should probably wrap it up. So want to thank you guys for coming on and sharing your insights. Any parting words of wisdom? You there's something you're just dying to get off your chest, or we've covered all the main points?
We covered a lot of stuff. There's definitely a lot of scholarship out there that is emerging. There's a lot of work on Marcion that's been coming out. Jason Badoon's work on reconstructing Marcion's gospel has been really great. Matthias Klingart is another. Marcus Vincent does a lot of really good work, and he dates a lot of this to the second century as well. And like I mentioned, that article by Jacques Savoy, it's called Authorship of Pauline Epistles Revisited, goes into some of our stuff on Paul, almost identical results. So there's stuff out there that's definitely some good reading if you're interested in kind of looking at it from this angle. And we also, like, you know, you had mentioned, we have a book on it. We are open to criticism and feedback, and we're looking forward to engaging with more scholarship and more scholars on this topic.
Absolutely. Yeah, the only thing that I would say is, you know, if you agree with us, check out our book, Christ Before Jesus. And if you disagree with us, check out our book, Christ Before Jesus. I mean, hey, we try our best to answer any questions that, you know, can possibly come up, because there can be some things that we got wrong. Absolutely. And there can be some things that we didn't explain too terribly great. So we actually do quite a few TikTok lives, as long as TikTok is still a thing. But we try to have some Q&A sessions and answer any questions and stuff like that. And we have an email and website and everything where people can reach out to us. And it's christbeforejesus.com. And our email is christbeforejesus@gmail.com. And I mean, people can definitely reach out to us and maybe just ask some questions if need be.
Yeah. And you look in the description. We'll have in the video description will be some links. So great. Okay, well, thank you for that. Appreciate the fact that you guys say you're open to criticism. You know, that just shows the dynamic nature of the ongoing textual criticism, that you guys are open to being saying, oh, hey, you missed this, or this was wrong. So that's very open-minded of you, and I applaud you for that. So thank you guys for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Check out, so everybody, check out the description, and if you want to read their book, check it out. Again, as I said, some of the points are controversial. That doesn't mean that they're wrong, and they could ultimately be proven right down the road, that they're actually on the right track. So thank you guys for coming on and discussing your work, and I hope everybody enjoyed this highly intellectual chat. So we'll see everybody on the next episode. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks for listening, and don't forget, we're on YouTube, so follow us on YouTube. Just search for Atheist Alliance International, and please subscribe and hit that notification bell. We're also on all of your favorite podcast platforms, so make sure that you follow us on there as well. See you next time.